chasing the corporate ladder, you know. But are they happy? Are you happy? You know, it's that. I mean, I can't say that I'm happy every day. I try to be, but it seems like people have just kind of lost themselves in the last, I don't know, 5 years or so. It's a very strange thing.
David, are all the songs brand new, or did you revisit and develop any ideas going back to the original sessions?
One song is something I recorded with Gorka Alegre. Gorka Alegre is a bass player from Spain.
Okay.
He join me on the UDO tour in 2019. I was the special guest on the Steel Factory tour opening for Udo. And my normal bass player couldn't fill all of the dates. Cork had joined up with me and finished, I think, 12-15 shows. Cork and I wrote the song. It's called The Beauty. And he heard that I was making a new Bangalore choir record. And he said, David, do you remember the song The Beauty? And I said, no. And he said, let me send it to you. It's perfect for Bangalore choir. And when I heard it, I went, oh, I remember. So the vocal was finished. There was a little too much noise going on, so I kind of put some more instrumental tracks in it. But yeah, that's the only song, I think. It's probably 5-6 years old that I had forgotten, to be honest, that I had written it with him.
Wow.
And everything else is new.
Okay, good to know. And beyond Bullet Train, are there?
I must say, I re-recorded, and Giles pushed me for this. I re-recorded the song Prisoner from Eat to Heat with Accept.
Oh, okay.
But I did a new version that's heavier, and I think it's the way Prisoner should have sounded originally. I mean, I never was a fan of the song on Eat to Heat. I just felt it was a little sugary, but now it's a little punchier, like Bullet Train. And
I can't wait to hear it. I can't wait to listen to the song. I can't wait.
Yeah, it's the opening. I think it's opening track on side or act two.
Act two.
But, that song I did re-record the vocal, and Giles actually had some backgrounds on that one, but I wanted it more guitar orientated. And it's similar. I didn't step out of the box too far, but as I said, everybody loves the song, but I always felt like I do it a little bit better.
I love the album when there are two parts. Volume one, volume two, it's amazing. It's like, like a book. And
That was another concept with Brave Words. That's kind of like the meatloaf story thing. Simon, let's make this something epic. And funnily enough, I don't know how many, I think we're just have enough space to put 16 songs on a CD because of the time restriction. We just made it by like 45 seconds. It's incredible.
Wow. The new cover clearly echoes the original On Target style. Who created the artwork design? And you did it?
Me. It's my concept in my head.
Okay.
And I have to give you that story as well, which is credit where credit is due.
Okay.
I knew the woman on the Target and everything. I wanted to catch the eye because it's On Target Part 2. So I have done a lot of recording with the band. Some of the guys are from Russia. Some of the guys are in Holland. Some guys are Italian. They're called Goot.
Goot.
G-O-O-T. I highly recommend the band. They're fantastic people. The bass player, Simon, is a graphic artist.
Mm.
And they came to visit me when I was in production for this, and I said, I've got to have a similar image. So I said, do you see this album cover? You know, the pinup girl kind of visual thing. I need to kind of go retro and get there. And I said, Simon, I'm looking for that. And he goes, let me play with some ideas. So I'll give Simon the artistic, kudo.
Okay.
But it was my concept, but he took it to a whole level. He deserves a lot of credit. So if anybody's interested, Simon Zoot, fantastic. He's great to work with. He's professional. And yeah, so I had to do everything similar, if I'm going to call it, On Target Part 2. You have to go retro, and you have to think nostalgia.
Remind me of you. Been a long just a man.
Target in 1992 versus Part 2, what do you feel has evolved most in your writing, lyrically and artistically?
Well, I'm more mature as a writer. I always felt that I could write songs. You know, being in an accept, you know, it was, there was a language barrier and they wanted to conquer the United States and be more commercialized, so I would offer kind of a street vibe lyric, and Wolf's ex-wife was called Deffy on the albums. Mm-hmm. She pretty much wrote all the lyrics for the band because of the language thing. So that was a battle, but that was when I really got my first started writing lyrics and melodies to records and learning. I've improved, I think. I've never been a fan of like, whoa, whoa, baby, baby, baby. You know, I like lyrics that say something.
Okay.
That are subjective. Like your interpretation of Prisoner might be different than mine. Bullet Train, we just explained it. But I like to write lyrics that are, it means this to me. And then somebody said, well, I thought it meant that. And I'm like, it could mean that. You're right. So I feel like I've matured there. I like to write meaningful words. Anybody can write party rock. You know what I mean? A turtle could write party rock. But vocally, I think I'm there, you know, comparatively to 92. It's not easy because a lot of these songs are way up in space in the range. But I take care of myself. I don't party. I don't drink. I sleep well. I sing every day. That's another thing. If you're going to write songs, it's an effort every day. If an idea pops in your head, sit down and write it down. You know, I've got pages of kind of half stories. And sometimes if Andy sends me a riff for Eric or Diego, I'll look at all this mess of words and go, that would work. And I just sing it into my phone and then I save it. And that's always been kind of my mantra for my epic work. But I will say, except on me, you know, from going from a cover band singer into a band of that stature, that's when you get in the big leagues. It's time to get to work and get serious, you know. So I carried that from Accept in the BC, the first album, and since then with my career. But yeah, I think I answered your question.
Yes, of course. Either hit.
But, oh, comparing. Yeah, it's similarities. There's a song called Still the Same on the record. It's Freight Train Rolling. There's a Driver's Seat is Slipping Away. There's another one called, my mind just went like, How Does It Feel? It's kind of got an Angel in Black vibe to it. So yeah, there's similarities because I knew I had to go there, but I didn't want to do it identically, you know, because of course everybody would criticize me. No, you just wrote another on target, you know? So I think I've grown, you know, but I don't take all the credit for that. I mean, the rest of the players, especially Andy, his gifted writing ability and guitar playing is amazing. And don't forget, and Mario Percadani and I wrote three songs on this record. Mario played with Hardline, and he's an amazing guitar player, great singer, and he's really hard to work with because he wants the best from me vocally. When I'm behind the glass with Mario Percadani, if I'm not selling the song to him, he'll tell me, no. And we've got another track out of the three that we wrote together. It's called I Never Meant To. It will be the third single.
The third single, huh?
This song is about my life and my relationship since my divorce, mm-hmm. my first marriage, my kids. It's a really personal ballad. And I think it's the one that will cross over, just not straight with metal radio or hard rock radio. It's got more of a contemporary vibe, and Mario is amazing at that melodically. I don't want to leave out Mario. He was part of this as well.
She always wins. I stick in the garment.
hit from 1989 has been reevaluated by many fans. How do you see that album's impact on accept and late 80s heavy rock today?
It's a strange thing, brother. You know, when that record came out, the original fans hated me terribly, and the new fans loved me. There was no middle.
Okay.
A lot of the dedicated German fan base thought it was a sellout. Why did you change Udo? He's our man. And I believe Udo is my opinion. He's a dear friend. I've always believed. Because what you must understand about the European audience, they're loyal to the group they follow. You could put out a couple of lame records, but they'll never abandon you. Whereas in America or North America, you know how it is. If you put out a stinky record, they forget about you. But the difference with the European audience is that they're very loyal. They stand by you from the day one to the end. And as a matter of fact, with Udo, we used to go see him play before Eat the Heat was released when he had his solo band. And one night I asked the management, I said, what is it about him that everybody loves? And they looked at me and they said, he's one of them. And it hit me like a dump truck, because he is. He is Solingen, Germany, homebred, one of them. And here I am at the time, you know, in fabulous physical shape, dyed blonde hair, hitting the girls. Wasn't what accept was it. So some people took it offensive. But I will say, to answer this, the strange thing about this record is they re-released Eat the Heat, like 3,000 orange vinyl reissue, while I was on tour with Udo on the Steel Factory tour. And every night somebody would come up, more than one person usually, at merchandise and say, would you sign this for me? And I'm like, oh, Eat the Heat. And they go, you know, I really hated this when it came out, but I have to say this record is great. It's grown on me. Okay, 30 something years later, that's fine. But I play Ecstasy live, I play Generation Clash live, and I always have. But it seems like you said, that the album is starting to get the respect that it never got. It's really a weird thing, because in Europe, people hated me. They either hated me or they loved me, you know?
You did a great contribution, because it's like before you was another accept. But with you, you put the first bricks of the new accept of everything that came later.
Well, I must say, if you listen to Metal Heart and Russian Roulette, the band were getting more commercial. And the corporate people in New York said, we need to break this band worldwide because they're big in Europe, but we're not quite selling the numbers in the United States. And as everybody knows, that's the global market. You hit it big, you know, in America and Germany, you pretty much have the world. Mm-hmm. Where the Scorpions have the world, right? They're a global sensation. With that singer, Udo, they couldn't get the radio play that was so important in those days. So let's commercialize a little bit. But I'm very proud of that record, because, you know, I came out of the clubs. I was nobody. And I thought I had it all. But I remember Dieter Dierks telling me, you have a great voice, but you don't know who you are yet, your identity. It's my job to find that. And I think he helped me do that. And he also said later on in the production, you realize if this record fails, they'll blame you and they're going to blame me. And that's exactly what happened. They blamed David Reese and Dieter Dierks for the failure. So I learned a lot of really hard lessons. I mean, I record with Dieter. We start at 1 p.m, take a dinner break, go back and finish at 1 a.m. Well, 6-7 days a week. It was nonstop. My voice was so strong in those days. I could do a concert at 12 o'clock and then go in the studio and then do a show at night. I mean, the German way of working is pretty intense. So you get out of that club mindset, you know, where you have to cover Alfred, Dio, Paul Rodgers, Gillan, you don't really have an identity as a singer. He was right. Mm-hmm. You can do all those things, but we got to make it David Reese.
Wow. And looking back, what led you to split with Accept?
The communication was horrible. Management was really good at creating animosity amongst members, a lot of fear and anxiety. And it came to a physical altercation on tour in Chicago. I'd had enough, they had enough, and they fired me. I'm not proud of it, but I'm friends with one of the guys that I had problems with. We're friends now. But it just, we had high hopes. We went out and did like a month of club dates headlining. And then we were asked to go on the Wasp tour at Metal Church. And as the Wasp tour was going, the Headless Children, I think it was called, mm-hmm. their tour, ticket sales were not really strong. And I think everybody started to realize that Accept Eat the Heat wasn't getting the critical acclaim, wasn't going to be successful. Personality clashes in the band, culture clashes. We're not selling tickets like they thought they would. And nobody was happy. It was a miserable existence. And in all honesty, the band is Wolf Hoffman's band. And I was taking a lot of attention from him. He didn't like that. So we clashed. It's stupid because I admire him as a guitar player immensely. Can you imagine Aerosmith without Joe Perry?
Exactly.
They tried it. Yeah. It didn't work. And they know it doesn't work. I wouldn't say we had the brotherhood of Tyler Perry, but I always wanted a guitar singer relationship. And Wolf was, no, I'm the star of the band. And that you see now, Accept is really just him. Peter is back with Udo. And to me, UDO are more Accept than Accept is. But that's just my opinion. I mean, and Udo has the luxury of doing UDO or Dirk Schneider. He's doing the Balls to the Wall anniversary. He's got like three different careers happening at one time. It's beautiful.
Wow. I think you're a great person because you answer with. You're welcome. You answer in
accent. Well, I take the blame. I mean, I shouldn't have slapped the guy. I mean, it was ridiculous. I mean, but when a band breaks down, it's like a bad marriage.
Radio, your rock station.
You know, the good thing of all that happened with you in that situation, and there was a big, big band like accepting those years, was, I think, that in 1992, you released On Target with Vanguard Choir. Right in the middle of everything changed, everything was moving in the world, the grunge wave. What did you want to achieve with that album, and how did the climate affect its impact? David.
I can tell you, before I joined Accept, I lived in Los Angeles. And what we say in California is, you go to a restaurant, there's a waiter, and you ask them, you know they're an actor, wanting to be an actor. Everybody you meet is in a rock and roll band. I couldn't get arrested. Nobody cared. I did demos, blah, blah, blah. But when I left Accept, I returned to Los Angeles, and everybody knew who I was.
Mm-hmm.
So the momentum was really cooking. I had Howard Kaufman managing me, who managed Whitesnake, Emily, Hart, huge management. I had Warner Brother Records, Stevie Nicks' personal assistant, her personal manager was my personal manager. Yeah. And so I went from being in the bottom of the gutter. I mean, I wasn't rich when I left Accept, but I was known. So I got a deal after 9 shows. And timing, once again, we released the record. The first week was fabulous. We were added to 144 radio stations. People were patting me on the back saying, okay, you got a hit record, kid. Good, congratulations. There was talk of us going out on tour, opening for Whitesnake on Slip of the Tongue tour, Europe and Asia. And then about, we did some Badlands shows, some Lynch Mob shows. And then around 6 weeks after the release, everything stopped. Literally stopped. Oh. And grunge overnight was the new thing. They called me in the office and said, we're dropping the band. It's over. And I was shocked. They dropped all the rock bands, but I kind of look back in retrospect and I say, okay, here's all these guys wearing all these tight clothes, getting all the girls, doing the party videos. They all look the same on MTV. Then this city called Seattle and in Portland and these areas, these guys are singing about real life experiences. They're not wearing this $1,000 clothes and having all the girls in the band and their hair big and everything. And they look like the guy next door that is feeling the same pain and the same life, the same misery. And the message stuck. Yeah, they had great songs too. I mean, Soundgarden, I saw them in LA before they broke, and I was like, this guy Cornell, he's a god. Who is this guy?
Not Chris Cornell.
Sounded like Black Sabbath with a really great sound singer. I was like, but this band has something. Then I saw Alice in Chains open for Van Halen, and I thought, oh my god, what is happening? But yeah, it basically ended before it really had a chance. But in Europe and UK, Bangalore Choir were really big. And I was told the world was over for us, so just retire. Had I known that, I would have brought the band to Europe and played all over Europe, UK, because grunge really didn't touch the European shores for like a year later, 2 years later. Mm-hmm. But I knew deep in my heart that grunge was going to be one of those things that lasts 4 or 5 years. And I was right. It's, it kind of died, killed itself off. It was a phenomenon, and then it ended. And sadly, if you think about all of those great singers, Lane, Chester, Chris, they're all gone.
Exactly.
So the survivors are Eddie Vedder and Anthony Kiedis.
That's all.
Isn't that remarkable?
It's incredible.
It's nuts. Scott Weiland. I mean, all fabulous frontmen, great singers, gone.
The record label, they should share the promotion, the marketing. They should share the
promotion. It's all about money. It's about money. It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Not it's money.
I have a possibility of going out on a co-headline tour with Babylon AD. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to the agents and managers, and I have to give a great shout out to Brave Words Records and Michael Brandbold. He's doing media work for Babylon and me, obviously. And I was talking to them about how overdone these tour packages are in America, where we're talking about touring together. It's the same band, same four bands every time they come through. And I've had so many fans say, why don't you come over and play America? Of course, I would have to use American band because of financial reasons, which I already have lined out. But promoters need to give these bands like me, mm-hmm, and others a shot at these festivals and these tour packages, okay? Because you can only have those four same bands every year, three, four times a year, come through your territory before people get tired of spending that $50 to $75 a ticket and they're playing the same set list. For God's sakes, let's put some life back in rock and roll. Yeah?
Absolutely.
So we're working on that, you know, for early, late March, early April. Maybe we can do a double headline tour together and have another band that's people know, a three-band package like we're doing with Bangalore Choir, Alcatraz, and Girls School over here in Europe. True. We've got a lot of shows.
Yes, David. Great. How did you first get involved with Circle of False Silence?
That's part of the grunge thing where I've told this story a million times, but I'll tell you. I remember being at a barbecue party. I used to rehearse at the same place that Ronnie Dio did and a lot of bands. And the woman that owned the rehearsal area had a barbecue. And I was in the kitchen and Janie Lane was there. I think Stephen Piercy was there, Fred Percy. All those guys were there and we're all looking at each other going, what are we going to do? It's over. And I had known Greg Chason from Badlands, the shows that I'd done with Badlands, Bangalore, and I called him and he said, yeah, I got this great thrash guitar player. He's into the heavy stuff, dark stuff. We should get with the times and try to do kind of a grunge blues heavy rock record. So we got together and what happened, I think the first Circle of Silence record was phenomenal.
I mean,
you know, I think it's a great one, you know, Dancing on the Sun. I mean, there's some great songs on that record. Suicide Candyman, there's some good ones on there, but it was a little bit left field. But what I tried to do was get current with what was happening in the music business. And the real fans of me knew I was trying to do that. And the grunge fans, they knew it wasn't real. It wasn't grunge.
Wow.
So a lot of bands took that road trying to stay relevant. And, you know, I mean, they were still giving out pretty good money for record deals. So I did okay. We did a few shows, but it really didn't happen. So what the outcome of that was total. I always think if I did not have a nervous breakdown, I do not want to know what one was. Because fired from Accept, put together Bangalore Choir, biggest management, great big label, all of this talk of touring. And then 6 weeks later, it's over. And then I tried to do Circle of Silence. Nothing happens. I finally said, enough. I retire. It's over. So for 9 years, I disappeared.
But David, the lineup of Circle of Silence was a VIP lineup, huh? This is Jay for Hurricane and Rally Child. Jess, he continuing Jess. She's a guy else. No.
Hey, Shellen, yes. Amazing drummer. Larry Marcus on guitar.
Larry, wow. I mean, it was Holy Soldier. Come on.
Yeah.
Guys, you're in the white.
Amazing. Amazing guitar player. Amazing guy.
The lineup was amazing. And you, from Accept, from Bangalore Choir. It was a super group.
The first album,
it's a gem, it's a hidden gem. It's very hard to find.
You know, I was one of Judas Priest when Halford left. I was one of three people that they were listening to, like Tipton and KK. Uh-huh. And the song Dance, they had the first Circle of Silence album. They liked my voice very much. They knew I had been an accept. I got a fax going, we really are interested in you. We've got your record, Dancing on the Sun, all these songs, fantastic. But we have two other guys we really like. And I said, who are they? They wouldn't tell me. I found out later it was Ripper Owens and Ralph Sheepers. But I was one of the three guys being considered to audition for After Halford Love on that record.
Wow.
Yeah. Their manager was writing, well, back in those days, we did faxes. It didn't work out. You know, Ripper deserved the job. He was great. I mean, Scott Travis saw him in a Priest tribute band and said, hey, I saw this guy. He's amazing. You know, we should check him out. So, but yeah, that's one good thing that Circle of Silence did for me.
Okay.
But I disappeared. I decided, you know what? I'm going back to my regular life.
Okay.
And thankfully, you know, I had done construction and I'd had to work for a living in the business so I could eat. And I learned a lot of skills. I ended up in Montana going back to cowboy work, working a ranch. And I didn't have a computer.
No.
You know, it wasn't really, we lived so far out in the country that nobody really had a computer. They did all their book work by hand. And you know, if you did have a computer, it was dial up. And I raised hunting dogs as a hobby besides ranching. I like to train bird dogs. Yeah, I like to bird hunt. I've hunted Canada. I've actually, to answer your question about Canada, I've been there without playing bird hunting and deer hunting. I did go to, you know, Saskatchewan and Alberta and do a lot of hunting while I was in Montana. But a lot of people are offended by my hunting passion and I don't really talk about it, but I'm okay with it. But anyway, long story short, I was raising dogs and running competitions as well. And a guy I met in Canada came down to buy a dog for me, an IT specialist, and said, where's your computer? I got to check in with my work. I said, well, I don't have one. He said, what? You guys can have a computer. And I'm like, I don't know anything about it. So he said, I'll tell you what, I'll trade you a nice computer for this puppy.
Oh my.
I said, okay. So he comes back down, sets me up. I got my dial up. Takes 30 minutes for the screen to come up. He builds me a MySpace page. I log in. And that day, I had, I don't know, hundreds of people going, oh my God, where have you been? We thought you were dead. It was 9 years.
Yes.
And so I had 3 band offers that day.
Oh my God. And Davey, from Accept to On Target to Circle of Silence, what's the through line that connects those chapters to On Target Part 2 today?
I think it's just my love for On Target. And, you know, I really tried to get Curtis back involved with me and John. I called Ian Mayo, the bass player, and Danny Greenberg sadly passed away a few months ago from cancer. So Ian had replaced him anyway. But I said, Ian, is there any way we can put the original lineup together? And he said, no, they're all retired. So then I reached out to Andy. But my journey has come full circle.
Okay.
And I really want to tell your listeners, On Target Part 2, I firmly believe, if you like Bullet Train, fasten your seatbelts, because this record is really great.
You know, it's Broken Radio, your rock station.
But look where we are. We did it all together, and it don't seem that far. Not a question of courage. We live and die by the song. Yes, we do. Victory is ours, hands in the sky.
And David, if someone has never heard Bangalore Choir before, which one track from the new album would you tell them to start with and why?
I'm going to give you two.
Okay.
Bullet Train, obviously, is the first video on release. That gives you a taste of what it is. I want to say, for another rock song, the next single, Driver's Seat, the very positive message. Top down in the car, cruising the highway, you're in control of your life, in the driver's seat. And the second song is the one we talked about earlier, I Never Meant To. This song means so much to me. And everybody that's heard it, I brought them to tears. And they get it. It's a very heavy ballad about my personal journey, making amends, asking for forgiveness, and forgiving some people in my life.
Okay.
And I hope it reaches everybody that hears it. That's what I would say. The rest of the album rocks. I've got a colorful palette of piano ballads. I've got heavy songs. I've got kind of kooky songs. There's one called Swimming with a Shark that's about meeting a crazy girl in a bar in San Francisco. You know, she comes in from Athens. I mean, it's nuts. The lyrics are crazy.
I don't have that. This is going to be a personal, super personal language. Fantastic. I want to listen.
I can't wait to hear it, man.
Yes.
You know what we should do? We should do another interview, like maybe do Act 1 podcast, and then we could do Act 2 after you get the full album.
Perfect. We can talk about that. I love that two parts, but it's like a two chapters. It's like,
absolutely,
sometimes it's like a Lord of the Rings, you know?
Yeah.
To figure out that.
Yes.
Lord of the Rings. But one, two,
trilogies.
Three. Yeah.
You got to keep. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
The lyrics are fantastic. Oh my God. And finally, David, what message would you like to give to the Rockum audience and to fans around the world waiting for this album?
There's a lot of things I could say. First, thank you to you and your passion and keeping the music alive. Because I believe there's two kinds of musicians. There's the players and the listeners. My fans, I how do you thank people that stay with you for 40 years? It's a feeling of the gratitude I don't have the words for it. When somebody comes up to me, I actually, with the Bangalore Choir, back to that, the first album, I played a show in Europe, and I won't say who it was. He handed me the record to sign, and he said, "This song saved my life." I said, "What?" And he said, "I was going to commit suicide. But what you said in the lyrics saved my life that night." I didn't know how to react. I started crying, and he was crying, and he hugged me. I mean, really hugged me. I walked out of that show going, "Oh my God, I've never heard anything like that before." So that made me just feel so grateful, you know. The people that believe in me, I thank them from the bottom of my heart, my wife, my kids. And for now in my life, I'm a comfortable human being, because for many years I was not comfortable in my own skin. Giving up alcohol for all these years was a great blessing. You don't have to do that to yourself. Rockers out there, you don't have to party. Write music, rock on stage, go get crazy on stage. Yeah, if you believe in your music, that's all that matters. Don't be discouraged, because these days we're actually got the blessing where we can release it ourselves. We don't have all these people saying, "Oh, we're not." Keep fighting. Like you said about me, I'm the weapon of mass production. I can't stop. I'm not. Maybe I'm too stupid to quit. It's like a rodeo rider, bull rider. One day they tell them, "Hey, you break your neck again, you're going to be in a wheelchair." But they got to do one more ride. It's like me. Thank God I can still sing a little bit. You know, until that time comes, I'm going to say, if I get to where I have to use backing tracks and stuff, I'm going to retire. I'm not going to do that to the fans or myself. I'll know when that time comes. But right now, I've got a hell of a ride happening. And I'm so proud of this record, proud of the team, thanking you from my heart. I thank all the fans. That's all I can say.
Beautiful. And it's true. The music can save lives.
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. I mean, how many emotions can you feel from a song? Sadness, anger, happiness.
Life.
Energy. Oh, God, I get in my car and I'm so angry. This guy's driving like crap. Crank my radio.
Exactly.
Get in a fight with your friend. Get in the car and forget about it. You can share it in a room. I mean, they've been doing that since cavemen, making music in caves, banging on sticks and singing and making noise and joy. Music is psychology for the soul.
Exactly. Maybe a song in the future. Now you have the idea.
Yeah. Well, actually, I've written, I told you there were 24 songs and 16 made it to the record. And that last eight are pretty good. I'll revisit those. I might have another act three already recorded, and I may have to write act four. I don't know. But I'm going to see. I'm just going to give it everything I've got over the next few months. And I know the record is strong, and I really, I got to thank radio too. They've wrapped their arms around this more than I've had in years. Metal Shop and all of these radio stations are really behind it. They're actually playing the new single, Bullet Train, and now they're playing On Target songs in their playlist.
Wow.
And I'm like, bravo, you know? Thank you for that. The guys in the band are like, Reese, you realize they're playing it full-time in Cleveland, Ohio. They're playing it in Washington, D.C. They're playing it in Dallas, Texas, Scandinavia, in New York. I'm like, what? Every day. And I'm like, this is great. And shout out to Brave Words and Michael Brandbold and Henderson and Brian Adams. All those guys are really, they believe in me. So that helps a lot. Giles Lavery, a lot. I thank them from my heart.
Yes, and I believe in you too.
I believe in you, brother.
Perfect. Well.
Okay, Jim.
Thank you so much. See you.
Thank you very much. And good luck, my friend.
Well, my friend.
Write me back. Let's do another interview with when the album comes out. Maybe we can do two separate ones.
Okay.
You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
Hello out there in Radioland. You're now listening to the charts produced here at CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. I'm DJ Squared, your host. And usually we bring you the top 15 top charting albums, but this week we've got 16 top charting albums.